AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
Oh, the car from Carvana's here. Well, will you look at that? It's exactly what I ordered, like, precisely. It would be crazy if there were any catches, but there aren't, right?
Right, because that's how car buying should be. With Carvana, you get the car you want. Choose delivery or pickup, and a week to love it or return it.
Buy your car today with
Carvana.
Delivery or pickup fees may apply. Limitations and exclusions may apply. See our 7-day return policy at carvana.com.
Welcome, everyone, to a special episode of Kiwi Talks to celebrate the 10th anniversary of Donkey Kong Country Tropical Freeze. It's a good way to feel old. And with me today are two artists that worked on the game, and I love these guys so much, Ted Anderson and Eric Kozlowski. How are you guys doing?
Doing good.
Doing great, thanks.
Yeah.
I didn't wear glasses when we shipped Tropical Freeze, so that should tell you something about the passage of time.
Yeah, well, hey, I'm the same.
Up here as well.
Yeah.
A lot more scalp showing up here.
And Eric wanted to emulate Retro Studios, and that's why he's got a bit of a retro camera thing
that's
going
right. on. Yep, called total pixelated style here, representing.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, obviously, we'll start at the beginning. What was it like at the beginning, the announcement, obviously, internally, that you guys were doing a sequel to Donkey Kong Country Returns? Do you remember that?
I remember feeling it was really expected. Donkey Kong Country Returns had done so well, and you know, it just felt like a natural fit. I can't remember if we had heard about the Wii U yet, Eric.
Because it's funny because like when I joined, like right after I think I might have mentioned this before, like it was the first time in my career, and maybe the only time I've joined the studio not knowing what I was going to work on, because typical Nintendo secrecy. Mm. And that E3 was when it was known that Retro was co-developing Mario Kart 7 with EAD. And so I was like, oh, I guess I'm going to be working on Mario Kart 7 for the 3DS. Mm-hmm. But I remember when I started, they had like a separate room where the engineers were working on the Wii U that you needed like key card access. So I think that might've been the first time I learned about the Wii U.
Ah,
for
right.
me, I don't know if that was the case with you, Ted. So, but I think that was my first kind of like, oh, this is Nintendo's next system. It's got a screen on it and stuff like that. So it was like very secretive, you know, like only the engineers were kind of like messing around with it. And then I remember they let me go back there and they showed me like a prototype pad, and that was the old one that they showed that didn't have the analog sticks. It had the the circle pads kind of dealy. So
did it click with you, the Wii U, or were you looking at like, I don't quite get this yet? Because I remember the devs when they were working on Prime 3 and they first got the Wii remote and they were like, what? They were a bit surprised with it at first.
I mean, I think conceptually I was like, oh, this could be really cool. But I think I do remember scratching my head of like, okay, how do we incorporate Donkey Kong into this? Like maybe when you do a bonus room, you go to the second screen or something like that. I remember thinking that, like, all right, how are we going to utilize this thing? And then we ended up not utilizing it at all. But I remember like, oh, maybe when you go into the background sections of the level, maybe that's the second screen. So that I think that was my, because I was thinking more about like the game we were developing rather than what is EAD going to do with this? Like, what is, you know, the next Zelda game going to do with this? What is the next Mario game going to, I wasn't thinking like that. I was more like, I don't know how you would do a 2D platformer that really takes advantage of this.
Mm.
Right. I mean, I didn't really think about the handheld nature of the screen beyond when they, thinking of, oh, that's kind of a neat idea because of, I think one of the things, Michael Kelbaugh probably mentioned it during a meeting about it, talking about how one of the aspects was that, you know, parents could watch their TV shows or while the kids play the game and, you know, so on and so forth. Yeah. Or they could do multiplayer where, like, you know, it's on the screen and one person's holding the pad and another person the controller. And like, it was very much the prototype Switch in that regard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. I think they needed to do the Wii U in order to get to the Switch.
Yeah. And that's the thing about Nintendo, though, is like, they sometimes do their best work when they're kind of backed into a corner.
Yeah.
And then they, like, right, then they get like crazy and they don't play it safe and they do some weird stuff, you know, and, you know, you get the Switch. So,
yeah. So with the game, because I would imagine that art is quite far along the chain, right? Because the designers have to prototype rooms and do blue rooms and all that, and only when it's finalized would art start to be put into it.
Well, we started experimenting pretty early on just because we had already made a DK game. So we kind of started making just kind of a linear section, like this is what the ground would be like, this is what a jump through would be like, this is what the backgrounds could be like, you know, just kind of doing a little beautiful corner of it, as it were. And correct me if I'm wrong, Eric, we started with the Alps. I can't remember what their actual name
is. No, I think, so yeah, oh, yeah. So it was, I think it was the mangroves. Cause I think like, so one of the big things, oh, like,
you're right.
It was like, the big question was like, okay, like returns stat, like you guys, cause I didn't work on returns, Ted did. And so they had established the look of this new generation of Donkey Kong, you know, taking the torch from Rare. And so I remember the big question was, okay, now how does this look in HD? Now we can use normal maps, you know, like that was, mm-hmm. oh shit, finally a Nintendo system can handle HD. And so that was one of the big questions, is how do we translate this style that was established in Returns into the HD era? And that was the first big hurdle. So when I joined, the team was still 90% like on the finishing touches of getting MK Mario Kart 7 out the door. And it was me and one of the artists, Elvin Schaefer's, and we were just kind of messing around with like tree shapes, because I remember hearing that mm-hmm. like the palm tree in Returns became one of the like the iconic signifiers of the art style of Donkey Kong Country Returns. And so we were like, okay, well, we could do that again for Tropical Freeze. And so I think that's why our jungle level was the mangroves. So like that was going to be our jungle level. And so it's okay, DK synonymous with jungle. What do these mangroves look like? And then when me and Alvin, we did a couple of, you know, went nowhere experimentations. And then when the whole team rolled off of MK7, that's when, like as Ted said, we started doing those kind of like a strip of like, what is this like little vignette going to look like with some trees in the background and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
So are you guys all isolated? So artists in one section, animators in another, engineers in another, or in the offices, are all the different teams kind of all meshed in together? So you can all, I suppose, look at each other's work, or is it very much
you're here? I remember at the studio where we started with it, that it was a little more enmeshed, but barely. But by the time we were at the new studio, it was very separate. Like, programmers were on their own like wing of the building, and art was all kind of on its own side. Then character art even was its own little subsection as well.
They were kind of under the umbrella of the animation department. Animation cast a pretty long shadow at Retro. They were kind of like a very important part of the pipeline. And I think when I joined Retro, I was only in the original location for, I think, about 6 months before we moved to the new location. And those were like these big offices that were like, my office had three desks in it. So it was me, and I forget, I think it was Reed and maybe Amanda, I think I was with in the office that I was in.
Sounds about right.
So I was with two other artists, but Ted, I don't know who you were with.
Gosh, who was I with?
You might have been with Elvin, right?
I think I was with Elvin initially. Yeah, no, that's right. Yeah, I was with Elvin.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Did you work with the animators quite a bit though? Because I would think that would be the group you'd work in coordination with the most. If you were to work in conjunction with
it depended. Like I worked on Horn Top Hop, which had the synchronized music with the leaves. And Ted, you worked on some of the Bright Savannah stuff, right? Did you work on that level? The Lion King level, as everyone knows?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that required a lot of coordination with animation. But a lot of times, not so much. We would identify this is a prop that needs to animate, and then we would make sure that is its own special actor that would be loaded into the level separately. Otherwise, the level itself was just one big chunk of art, like a massive file that just got dumped into memory. And then all the animation stuff was then attached. Yeah.
Did you playtest a lot as you were doing that? Yeah, we did.
I remember that was probably one of the most amazing aspects of working on that game was how tight the design was. For the levels, like they were built to be speed ran, and
it was
just amazing the like clockwork complexity of how they had timed jumps to coincide with it. Was very rhythmic, and it still amazes me to this day. I mean, it's just the ability to hold that kind of design in your head and then to actuate it.
I remember clearly I was working on Meltdown Mayhem, I think it's the last level in the game when you're on
with the lava.
I was working on that, and I remember going to the designer, and I can't remember his name. Was it Brandon? I forget. My apologies. But I remember going to the designer and saying, "This level is impossible. Like this is unbeatable. Like there is no way." Like I was, and then by the end of like my time working on the level, I was like blasting through it, like because you just play it so much, you just got so good at it. But your first attempt, like any other game, you don't know, and you get your ass kicked. And so it was so tightly designed that like you master it through practice, and that's how you could just get that, like Ted was saying, that speed run kind of instinct, where you're jumping before a platform even appears because you know the timing it's gonna be there. So yeah, like playtesting the levels was always kind of like, it was like very important because you got to see how the art was like parallaxing. You know, is this a cool comp? When I get to this part of the level, is this a cool composition here? You know, like it might be cool in a static shot, but as you move across and things kind of parallax, like, is that still interesting? So playing the game in motion helped you determine like really cool compositions for the level art.
I remember
you keep going. This is interesting.
Yeah. No, I remember we would have talks about places where the flow of the level would slow down, and that would be a place where we could really stretch our legs as far as composition goes, because the player would have a chance to see it, you know. Because otherwise it'd be like, yeah, they're gonna blast past it super quick. Do you really need to spend a week designing this background that no one will ever see?
And the very first asset that Ted and I collaborated on was this giant steamship in the mangroves, and I kind of modeled it out. I did some really early base kind of textures just to get the UVs in the right spot. And then Ted went in and like textured the hell out of it, made it look awesome. And then we kind of like broke it up, but we knew, like Ted was saying, that like this was going to be right in the player's viewpoint right before you jump into the minecart and start the level. So we knew that this is a moment where this set piece can really capture the player's attention because the action hasn't really started yet. Because once you're in the minecart, things are moving around, the level is rotating, but we knew that we had the captured audience at that point. So it's like, okay, let's give them a cool visual. And it was like a really kind of fun, it was a fun collaboration. I remember really enjoying working on that with you, Ted. Like that was definitely a fun asset to build. So.
Oh yeah, I mean, I've always loved working on machinery and games too. So like as soon as that came up, I was just like, yep, please sign me up.
Yeah.
Yeah, I actually want let's show off like some of your work here, because this stuff is sick, and people probably don't get to see it. All right, so you have talked about the Grassland Grooves a bit before, Ted, in terms of like this, these puppets, right? Like puppet sticks that you made. What else do we have here? Oh, so you did some work on the third boss. This is the third boss, I think. Yeah,
I got thrown at a lot of the different boss fight rooms.
Do you sometimes lose track of what you're working on? Like, are you like, oh, where is this again? Because obviously, I'm imagining you're working on multiple levels or multiple pieces of art from different parts of the game at multiple times, right? So you have to keep track of what you're working on.
Yeah, definitely that. And then, like, one of the things that was nice is as the game just accrued assets, like, by the time you did get to the boss level, you had so much cool stuff to work with. You're just snapping up pieces and parts from different levels and repurposing them. And, you know, it's, you can really see that here where you've got, like, little huts in the background. You've got the little kind of, like, rope bridges and whatnot. The big, what are those kind of trees called?
The baobab trees.
Baobab, yeah, the big baobab trees, and it was just get to pluck from a lot of different places.
So these penguins, for example, an animator would have put them in, and then you just beautify them, I guess? Is that how it works? Like, with, because obviously you've got static images and then you've got moving images, right? So where's the cutoff point between an animator and an artist? Would there ever be cross-pollination?
The animator handles, so each enemy or each animated thing in the scene is its own little like kind of point of data, if that makes sense. It's just a fixed point that's placed in the level, and then it accesses a model that then accesses a series of animations. And so I believe the designers were the ones who actually placed all the animated critters and enemies and whatnot.
Yeah.
Right.
And we could suggest, because I only worked on one boss arena, and that was Scow, and
this one here we go. Yeah.
And like my original intent on that one was to have all these owl perches in the foreground with owls kind of like on them watching you. But one of the biggest, and this is as an artist, you want to have depth, right? You want to create parallax in a world, and like design was like, you can't put things in the foreground that are going to block Donkey Kong. And so, you know, we had to take that out. But, you know, I think there was maybe some spots where they might have been in the background. But then there's also, like, can we afford it? Because animation costs memory. The characters are skeletal rigs. That memory right there. This was a pretty intense level because it was three levels high. And there was a ton of geometry in there. So like this one, I don't think we could have a ton of like extra characters in the background and stuff like that. So,
And then you had, stuff from the previous game, right? So, cause this was from Returns, and then you changed it slightly for Tropical Freeze.
Yeah. So like the whole last level was kind of like, the theme was, you know, going back to Donkey Kong Country Returns, but now it's iced over. And so I remember opening up a lot of the files that you guys worked on, Ted, and taking those assets and then looking at the textures and then doing my best kind of approximation, but in like HD kind of version of that to, you know, to evoke that look, but give it, you know, make sure it sits in the new style of this game. And then I remember seeing, I don't know if it ended up in the game. I think it did. Somebody did a piece of concept art of DK holding up like a Wii remote. And I think that was just a painting that was in the background in Returns. So I just modeled out Donkey Kong holding up the Wii U. I wish somebody would have got in there and changed that to a Switch for the Switch port. But
that's actually quite smart from a budgeting standpoint to utilize assets or art from the previous game and then putting it into the new game, but obviously changing it slightly, because that would save a lot of time, wouldn't it? as an artist, as opposed to doing new art for a whole world.
Yeah, I agree 100%. It works smarter, not harder. And maybe, as long as it fits and it doesn't look like you're just slapping in Wii assets into a Wii U game, you know, like that whole temple, like I remodeled because I don't think there was any temples that were that high res enough from a model standpoint. And then, like I said, I looked at the textures. So there wasn't a ton of like one-to-one. Those monkey statues, I think I took the base of that monkey statue and then like modeled out like more detail, added in more bevels and edges to it to give it more of a rounded, less low poly look. So I don't think there's anything in the game on the Frozen levels that is exactly, I just the exact asset from Returns. It's been at least touched by an artist to be updated because I just don't think it would have worked otherwise.
Yeah, yeah, that's fair enough. How long does it take to make one of these texture maps?
It depends on the complexity and if it works. Like texturing has always been one of my more weaker skill sets. So I was always really stoked when textures I made, you know, got in the game and were pretty well received, like the ones you're looking at right there. Like I didn't do any world building on any of the ocean levels, but I did get to work on the kit that Ted was talking about. Like, you know, Ted was saying when he was working on a level, but at a certain point, there's like a ton of art assets for you to build with. So I got to make a lot of these statues and so that brown texture with the pock marks, like that was pretty quick because it's not a very complex texture. Something with all the boxes in it, that took a little bit longer because it's a bit more complex. But yeah. Ted, you're the texture guru, man. So
thank you. I think for me, it always the main thing that'll determine how long a I remember those fruits. Those were fun.
That's a sick level, man. Honestly, that's a sick world, I should say. Like so
as juicy
creative
as possible. Yeah.
So creative.
Gosh,
right?
I mean, just so much. It's just so full of life. I love it.
Yeah. But it's just so creative, right? In terms of like a biome, you know, because you have like forests or fire or winter, but to use fruit, you know, it's not common, man. So.
Yeah. But as far as like texturing goes, for me, the one of the main determinants of like what takes the longest amount of time is kind of close to what Eric was saying. It's just there's more detail. Then of course you have more attention to detail. But also if it has like a lot of different materials on it, if I have to go through there and say there's like, you know, ropes and metal and wood and stone and plant life or whatever, all in the same texture map, then that's kind of like having each one of those individual textures within the map, and they require their own attention and color balancing and detail. And then, you know, just also at the end of the day, it has to fit into the stuff that's already there. And so you have to work with the other artists to make sure that you're using similar tones of green for your plants, similar tones of kind of like desaturated, creamy dark ends for woods, and then each level kind of ends up with their own theme after a while.
So just with this particular image here, if you remember, what do you think would have been the hardest to do the art just in terms of this?
The fruit, definitely. Yeah. I remember going back and forth with our art lead a few times, just trying to get the colors to pop. And then because they are so varied, you've got your reds and your cool blues, that we wanted to make sure that you always knew it was a surface you could land on and that it wasn't dangerous. Or that you didn't think it was going to be like a bouncy surface when you landed on it, that it was so different from everything else. This is something you can interact with. And we did go back and forth on that a bit, but I think we landed on something that, no pun intended, that worked.
But I mean, one of the interesting things I find is you'd probably have to take into account the color of Donkey Kong, right?
Oh yeah,
because you don't want him to kind of blend in where you lose track of where he is.
Yeah, that's why you'll notice a lot of the wood is mostly of a reddish hue, not of a brown hue.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we have a ton of wood in the game, but I mean, I guess the Autumn Heights levels, I guess the windmills have some brownish hues on them, but But again, you know, like the slats of the roof. I remember Ted and I talking about making everything because we knew like the owls were going to be a big presence, and so we're like, oh, it's owl theme everything. And then, you know, Ted was like, oh, let's make the roof shingles into feathers, and I'm like, that's fucking awesome, let's do it, you know, like,
yeah.
So lots of fun stuff there, but yeah, always making sure that DK was the focal point on the screen was always a paramount. I mean,
we so would definitely. Would you focus on the foreground stuff first and then work your way back to the background area, or was it a combination of both? Like, was there a template to it, or is just kind of you just feel
I'm
it
sure,
out?
I'm sure every artist had their own kind of way of working. For me, I'm pretty ADHD, so like, you know, like focusing on what's fun for the moment. You know, if I have like a cool vignette in the background that I want to get to before the stuff that's in the foreground, then yeah, I'll bounce around. But yeah, it just depends. And it depends, yeah. Like we would have like check-ins every 2 weeks. So like, if I knew that there was like a check-in coming, I would make sure that there was enough there for the leads to kind of like evaluate.
Yeah. And you got to do these props pretty much, right? So
the barrel cannon.
SMB3 tank.
Yeah. The barrel cannon didn't make it in game. They ended up going with a different one, but I was always happy with how that turned out. Yeah.
It looks like the same one.
Yeah. I think they went with something a little bit less detailed than I did, but I was very proud of the rocket barrel because I got to kind of like redesign. There was no concept. There was the rocket barrel from DK Returns, but again, we had to HDify it for this game. And so there was no concept art for it because we already had a rocket barrel. And so when they said, hey, Eric, can you build this prop? I remember being like, okay, well, how can I embellish it and make it look like the same asset, but better? And that's what I came up with. And I was fucking stoked when I saw the Mario Brothers movie that they used this design in the movie. Like, it's pretty close. And I was like, holy shit, that's pretty damn close. Like, there's obviously it's way more detailed in it and stuff like that. But I'm like, that's pretty close to the design that I came up with. And I don't want to take all credit. The original rocket barrel design is the fruit of another artist's labor. I just took it and then embellished it for Tropical Freeze. But seeing the embellishments that I added represented in the movie was a thrill. So
it makes me wonder if they do an animated DK movie. And I know they got the DK theme park that they're working on at Universal. Whether they'll use some of your art.
I don't know, man. It'd be cool. I mean,
they definitely would reference our work, you know.
Well, I mean, the tikis are going to be in the theme park, so Ted, like, I'm sure that, like, some of the stuff some of the stuff you did on Returns might make its way in. So, I did see the tikis show up in like the that was a fun level, the juicing one, because I got to. Yeah, the factory one with the square watermelon. Because that was a level, that's a prime example of what Ted was talking about. So like that level, I didn't really make any of the art or textures for that. It was a lot of kit bashing. It was a lot of taking elements that other artists had built on other levels and then reconfiguring them to work on the layout that I was given. And I would have to remodel things to fit. But it was, I didn't create anything from scratch. It was all about augmenting what other artists had already built. Whereas like Autumn Heights, you know, I modeled that horn from scratch. I made those birch trees from scratch. You know, obviously I textured the trunks. I think Ted, you might've done the canopies. I textured the horn, I'm pretty sure. So, but when it came to stuff like Fruity Factory in the Juicy Jungle, I don't think I created any, I didn't do any textures, anything like that. So it was always like, you know, finding the best kind of asset to fit with what you were working on.
It's cool to see the wireframes as well, because you don't get to see that often, right? You got the wireframe.
It is a nice touch.
Yeah, Nintendo is usually pretty. That one got by the Nintendo ninjas, because a lot of times I think the a lot of times Nintendo just likes what you see in game is what the artist should be able to show in their portfolio. But that one must have squeezed by, which after 10 years, it's fine.
Yeah. You know, yeah. But still, it looks good because you could see all the detail, and that really puts into context how much work goes into just making one thing, right? One object.
Mm-hmm. These were fun because I think each one of us got to pick a level and do a, because these are the rewards. If you create beat the secret levels, you get a little vignette. And I don't have any of the characters on mine, but because I did so many levels in Autumn Heights, I was pretty excited about being able to work on that one, because I got to do, I think, 3 or 4 levels in Autumn Heights, Rodent Ruckus, Windmill Hills, Horntop Hop, and Scout. So yeah, 4 levels. Yeah, and that's the steamship. That's the steamship.
That, yeah, you can see the level of detail here is crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was a tag was team between you two, right? So you two
Ted, I don't think we even had a concept on this one, right? I don't know. I don't remember there.
No,
being
you
a concept.
And I just worked together, and you just kicked out the model to me, and I just started jamming on it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it was like, let's put these awesome like metal slug kind of gun turrets. I remember being like, yeah, some metal slug gun turrets on it will be fun. And then I think it was your idea to put Squawks as the masthead on the front. So
I wish we had a shot of the boat plane. Was it a boat plane?
Oh yeah, I remember you and I worked on that as well. Yeah, and the submarine you and I worked on. Yeah. I modeled the submarine, and then you did the boat plane is in quite a few levels in the mangroves.
Yeah, we parted that thing out like crazy.
Yeah, the steamship ended up being like the kit for all the mechanical objects in the mangroves. Like artists took that texture library, they took meshes, and they cannibalized the crap out of that to make parts of levels and stuff like that. So. It's pretty cool to see that DNA peppered throughout.
Looking at this, honestly, it makes me wonder what you guys would have done on Prime 4. Seriously, with like some of the texture maps and just some of the art, like, because this is so sick. Yeah. I mean, particularly with like Prime, because you have a lot of mechanical stuff, and this, I mean, obviously it's a different style of art compared to Prime. But I would have loved to have seen what you guys would have done.
Yeah, would have been awesome.
I would have loved to have worked on something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a huge Metroid fan, and sci-fi is, like such a fun genre to play in. But yeah, I'm curious what direction they're taking the art style. Are they going super hardcore gritty? Are they going to do something more along the lines of Metroid Dread, which is a bit more clean and kind of like, very, very strong silhouettes. And I think Mercury Steam has like a really strong, like, house style. Like you could see the work they did in Castlevania, you could see that echo in Dread. Like
definitely
there's a couple of characters where you could be like, oh, I could see the character artist who modeled that character worked on Lords of Shadow and stuff like that. So I'm curious, the art director they have on Prime 4, I think he worked on Mirror's Edge, so I mean they're in good hands.
And I mentioned the wireframes, but the wireframes for anything Metroid related would probably be far more than this, I would think, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, if it's a Switch game, Switch is more powerful than the Wii U, but if it's a Switch 2 game, which again, I have no idea whether it is or not, if it's a Switch 2 game and they're saying Switch 2 might be as strong as like a PS4 Pro, maybe?
Oh, there's a number of rumors, and I don't know what to believe. Someone said it was like with DLSS, they can get it up to what series? Is it S? I lose track of which one's which. Is it S?
Yeah.
That's the weaker one?
S is the weaker one. So, it's always fun to have more. The thing that was always fun about Tropical Freeze and working on a Wii U is like, sometimes limitations are a great thing because it kind of really forces you to just focus on the necessities and really, especially on a cartoony game, silhouette is everything. It's all about the big reads, not the fine details. And so for Tropical Freeze, you know, it's like, it has to almost feel toy-like, right? Like you can't really get into that kind of like hyper-realism, hyper-detail. Like I'm curious for a first-person game like Prime, you know, with more horsepower, are they going to get into that kind of like Naughty Dog level of, you know, the grease dripping off of a oily panel and all that stuff?
How lived in will the world be?
Exactly, yeah.
Well, it still has to hold 60 frames per second, so
they'll have to
work all that out. I know when I spoke to you last time, Eric, you mentioned that you guys did crunch on Tropical Freeze. Yeah. Was it a small amount of crunch? How long was the crunch?
It was pretty long. I want to say.
It also wasn't just singular, because we would have milestones and there would be crunch for those milestones. And I remember there was a couple of those that were pretty gnarly.
Especially around like E3. There was the E3 push. That was a pretty gnarly one. The main crunch push for launch was pretty... I mean, I've done quite a few crunches in my time. Speaking... my own personal experience, every artist, every employee, every developer on the project has probably their own opinion on it. For me, it was pretty manageable. I didn't feel, I mean, obviously it was, you know, working weekends, which sucks, unpaid, unacceptable. Crunch is not an acceptable practice, but when I compare it to other things, like it, and this almost sounds like Stockholm syndrome, but it wasn't as bad. You know, they did bring in like, I remember they brought in a chair massage, you know, so we could sign up for free massage and stuff like that, which, hey, man, I took advantage of that. I was like, sure.
Why not?
Yeah. But that was my experience, you know. I think other departments had it way worse. Like, I remember VFX was really behind the eight ball. So I remember, like, Sean and Chuck, they were crunching way harder than I know than I was crunching.
I remember there was a time where I pulled on like Sean's entire task list.
I remember that
just to free him up for VFX. Mm-hmm.
Yep. So it was different for different people. And I know UI also was another department that kind of was a very tight finish, because people don't remember, but the game was originally supposed to ship November 2013 and
it got delayed to February.
So, but I do think those extra couple of months did make the difference to do some spec VFX, kind of get them going where they needed to get.
And I suppose you would have had less oversight from Japan as opposed to the designers, right? I mean, Nintendo of Japan would have been hounding the designers, I'm sure, because of their design philosophy and how much of an anal retentive they are with that stuff. But
And there was a couple of situations where they would come in and play test a level that was pretty arted and then say like, this is too short or too long, or this section is not fun and it needs to be redesigned. And you're like, but the art is done. And they're like,
but we
don't care. It's gotta be fun. That's the, you know, and it's like,
just real leaning into the mic and being like, that's great.
You know? I mean, I think Windmill Hills was one of those levels, and that's probably my favorite level that I've worked on. But that level was shorter at one point, and I think they wanted to make it a little bit longer, and I had to like, and then you know, make, like find a way to stitch in new art in between. But I think as far as the environment team goes, we didn't get a lot of aesthetic feedback, like you can't do this or you can't do that, like. The character team, like I was friends with Adam Schumann, who did a lot of the fur tech on the characters. And the fur tech on Tropical Freeze is amazing. But like he was showing me, like they sent over like color swatches for like every character. Like DK's fur has to be this exact Pantone color, like this. Yeah. Team. So like there were certain aspects of the legacy characters, Dixie, Diddy, Cranky, Donkey, Rambi, all of that, like, yeah, very, very much, you know. So, but they didn't really bother us. So, they, you know, like throwing in like a squawks on a steamship, they didn't bother us for that, you know.
Yeah, I can't really remember any times that we got like direct aesthetic feedback at all. It tended to be like kind of what you're saying is like design would get some kind of, you know, horseshoe thrown at them, and we would have be there to pick up the pieces.
Yeah.
I remember, God, it was the, I think it was actually the juice level got zinged for a couple of things. Not terrible, but I do remember having to go through there and then having to try and like splice together vines. And I'm sure that there's some vines that defy the laws of physics and loop back in on themselves and stuff. But like,
there must be a morale killer though, right? If you think you're done with something and then someone comes in and goes, nah, redo it again. You're like,
it's definitely a hit.
Yeah. So are there methods that you use to try and keep your energy up in those situations? Like, I don't know, listen to some music, drink a lot of Red Bull. I don't know.
Sometimes you have a little bit of a bitch session at lunch and you're kind of like, yeah, this sucks. And then, but then you roll up your sleeves and you get it done. And for me, at least, you know, like, yeah, in the moment, I'm like, this is BS, you know, they're crazy. We got a schedule to keep, but at the end of the day, you're a professional and this is the job you got to do and you kind of get it done. But at least for me, for the couple of levels where that happened. So,
yeah, I did want to ask.
I feel like that's necessary.
Oh, sorry. So you keep going. You go, Tim.
Sorry.
Yeah, you go. That's fine.
Yeah, no, I think it was just more necessary to blow off steam. And I mean, just even getting back to the idea of crunch, I think that's when any kind of like stuff getting bounced back to you would really just be like tear out your hair, because it'd be like, no, I was closer to the door. So that could be a bit of a bear, but typically, you know, I learned that like feedback, especially from Japan, if it was on anything aesthetic or even on design, like I learned to really trust them on that because they, you know, I mean, even in the games I make these days, you know, for myself or even for the companies I work at, there's a lot of really good lessons that I picked up from that, like, you know, just definitely carry them forward, you know?
Yeah.
So,
yeah. I think, just to touch back on like feedback from Japan, the only thing aesthetically was if we put any Easter eggs in the game, that had to get the sign off from Japan.
Oh, like Metroid stuff.
Yeah, like the Matt put the gunship in his silhouette level. You know, I put the gramophone from DKC1 in one of my levels. I put the whole level from Donkey Kong 3, the one with the Bugman, Stanley the Bugman, in the background. All that had to get approved. The Mario tank had to get approved.
How long does that take? Out of curiosity.
It was pretty quick, actually. A week, maybe.
Okay, that's not too bad.
Yeah.
Wasn't too bad.
So, and I had none of the Easter eggs I kind of proposed were denied, which was fun.
Yeah. I did want to ask about the whole expectation versus reality, because unfortunately Tropical Freeze was a victim of the rumor train and people building up expectations in their head. Then the trailer releases and it gets all this backlash. And how was that at the actual studio? And because that must have been seriously annoying.
I don't really listen or terribly care about what the public thinks.
Well, that's good
for me. I know that might sound a bit cold, but like I can't change how they feel about a game that's already out. And you know, occasionally you get somebody with a bit of knowledge who knows what they're talking about and they give you some good feedback, and that those tend to be more like well constructed. But occasionally you get folks who just have no idea what they're talking about and they just want to be the loudest one so that people will pay attention. Yeah. And I mean, to a degree, I get that too. But I also just learned pretty quickly that just like, it's just noise.
Yeah, Ted's better about that than I am. But I was at that E3 where we showed it off And I remember I get the hotel room that night, like reading through, I guess it would have been NeoGAF at the time. And, you know, it was quite a big thread about like, oh, Retro's new game is another freaking Donkey Kong. And, you know, that was just the internet getting themselves up into a frothy mass of like that Retro, for whatever reason, was going to do a Western take on a Zelda or something like that. And so everyone was believing this weird fever dream of what could be. And it's like, no, Donkey Kong Country Returns was like a really financially successful game. Yeah. Like it did
it sold
really
like
well.
10 million or something. So
yeah,
that thing did numbers.
Yeah. So like we're making a sequel, guys. Like this is economics here, you know? So like, we're not going to just chase a pipe dream because it'd be fun. So like
the least,
you know,
surprising news.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, because it sold more than like all of Retro's previous games combined, I think.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, so I totally understand it from a business perspective, from a financial perspective.
And you know, I guess, you know, in the end, we believed in the game that we were building. Like we knew it was fun. We knew it looked awesome. Mm-hmm. Like Ted said, there was some like uninformed idiots who were like, oh, they, like you were saying, like they just took assets from Returns and it's just like it's just more Returns. And it's like, no, this is all completely crafted from scratch and like completely painstakingly and lovingly, you know, created. And yeah, and it stood the test of time. I think a whole new audience discovered it when the Switch release came out. I literally just bought it for my niece for Christmas. She's like a Mario fanatic after like watching the movie and playing like all the games. And then I was like, I remember my brother was telling me that she got through Mario Wonder pretty easily. And I was like, when I gave her the game, I was like, all right, I heard you got through one. I was like, now you're ready for a real challenge. Okay. Here's a game that's gonna, you know, so I'm glad that the game 10 years on is still so highly regarded. Like, you know, I've seen it run in speed runs on Awesome Games Done Quick. Like I always love when I see like Spike Vegeta, you know, doing a run and like blasting through a level that took me a month to make in like 20 seconds. I'm like, oh, like how the hell, you know?
Yeah.
You know, but it's cool. It has that legacy, which is, you know, as an artist, you want your art to live on, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's a timeless game. It's a timeless game. I don't think it'll ever age. It's perfect, I would say.
As close as you can get, you know? I still look at parts and I'm like, ooh, well, I would do that different.
But that's because you know how the sausage was made, right? Yeah. I think anybody who works on a game would be like that. So, I mean, if there was a third Donkey Kong, you guys would probably enjoy it just because you're not involved in the development, right? Let's say if Retro developed another one.
Yeah, possibly. Sure. I would love to see what they would do next. Or any studio, you know? Like, by all means, take it on and give some fresh blood to it. I think it's a franchise with limitless potential. You know, you could take those characters anywhere and do anything.
I mean, it's such a fun, cartoony world that, like, really, the like you're saying, it's just the bounds are your imagination. So, you know, it's, you could have a giant steamship with you know, gun turrets on it, the same level that's got, you know, giant citrus fruits the size of a small building and
I do find it bizarre that there hasn't been any more Donkey Kong games since, considering it's one of Nintendo's best selling IP. Like, it sells more than Kirby, for example.
I think because of the Wii U was the failure that it was and that Tropical Freeze launched on Wii U, I don't think it did that well. And I don't know what
but
the Switch
I think
numbers
most
are
games though.
Yeah, but yeah. I think the Switch probably boosted it up quite a bit, but I guess, you know, at that point Retro had moved on to something else. And I mean, there's rumors now that EAD is doing a new Donkey Kong game, whether that'll be a Country or something else, I have no idea. But I mean, the character was prominent in the movie. There's talk of like a spin-off Donkey Kong movie with Seth Rogen, so, you know,
we'll see.
Yeah.
So before we go, I have got some questions from my community that wanted to ask some questions. There's so many, so I'm not going to ask all of them. Okay. I've just gone through a few. So we'll see how we go. If you can answer them, cool. If you can't, just say pass. No Nintendo ninjas here. Okay,
I might
so...
choose one not to answer and just be mysterious about why.
Yeah. Yeah, just do something with your eyes. Just like,
yeah.
Blink twice.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. So we got one from Brandon1793, and he wants to know what was it like working with Vince Jolly and Ryan Harris in particular. I don't know why those two, but.
You know, Vince was, he knew that world pretty well, that project pretty well. I think, mm-hmm. you know, Vince had an animation background, so he understood the dynamics of the character and how it moved. And I think Vince had a real love of kind of like Western animation. And I think there's a lot of that in DK. So I think like working with him, he understood the game pretty well. Ryan Harris, I mean, he was a producer, so I didn't really work with him. What was
he
a designer?
Would be like leading meetings every once in a while, but it was not like a direct interaction.
I'm assuming this question might have came off of Wikipedia because they're listed as like the names on like Wikipedia. So
yeah, I don't know why he chose those particular names. There might have been a particular reason, but he didn't state why. So I'm as curious as you are as to why those specific people, but okay, so next one is Mike UK 10. What was something prominently discussed during development that didn't make it in, and for what reason?
Digging the old memory banks on that one.
I mean, I have a couple, but again, I don't know.
we could be moving into dangerous territory here.
There was a couple of things.
I know there was some, was it a moon concept art? I think it was.
Yeah.
That didn't make the cut.
Right. I think early on, it might have been discussed, like, were we going to do the snow theme or like a Martian theme, where like, because DK punched the moon at the end of Returns, the aliens living on the moon were going to be the invaders. I think that might have been... But I remember seeing some
like concepts of that, but there was very few in number, and it was like almost like at the level of like doodles. Like, you know, wouldn't it be neat if never anything concrete.
So superfluous that it never even entered into like a model. Like, you know, like we were pretty settled early on with the snowmads and all of that as being the direction going forward.
That makes me wonder. So do you guys all just sit there in one big meeting and just brainstorm ideas? Is that how it works in these things? Like, or is it left to certain individuals to do that stuff?
I think at a high level, certain individuals. So like, I never had a, like I said, that's why like we're racking our brains. Like I don't remember like the core concept of Tropical Freeze, but when it came to like, I've talked about the clock tower inspiration for Windmill Hills, right? Like, being a Castlevania fan, like stuff like that, we could like brainstorm and say like I said, Ted and I sitting down and being like, hey, let's do a bunch of like feather, you know, imagery on these architectural pieces for the Alps. Stuff like that was within our purview because that was on a per level basis. But like, you know, like we didn't get to say like, hey, wouldn't it be cool if you could play as Cranky and Dixie in this game? Like that came from way above our pay grade, type of stuff like that. So.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that kind of leads into the next question, which is from a Dondi boy. I guess that's how you say it. Anyway, how did the snowmans come up? Were they always Viking penguins?
How did that come up?
By the way, I like them more than the Tikis personally.
I think they definitely have more personality, so I agree with you there. And it's not just because I was the voice of the penguins.
What? Just a random mic drop there. What the heck?
Yeah.
How did that happen?
No, I remember they the audio team put out an email asking if anybody wanted to come help out with sound effects, and I was in kind of a spot between big projects, so I went in there and volunteered. And they said, "Oh, well, you can do penguins." And I was like, okay, well, try and briefly think what a penguin would sound like. And The only thing that popped into my head, I'm not sure if you all remember that cartoon from the 90s, The Critic.
Mm-hmm.
But there was this episode where Jay Sherman's dad and mom go flying off on a vacation, and it tends to be really cut rate. And it turns out that, you know, their plane is going to go down, and the dad goes to the cockpit and he goes, "My God, the pilot's a penguin and he's been drinking." And then the penguin just goes like, "Quack, quack, 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 quack." It just, and that's just always stuck in my head. It's just the whole like, "Penguins can't fly." You know. So it's just kind of ran with that. And that's, you know, that's my little grumbly voice whenever the penguins are making noises.
So was it one take? Did you do it one take?
Yeah, just a whole bunch of different little like grabbly noises and, you know, different tones for like being happy, being mad, being frustrated, being just kind of like, you know, whistle while you work, kind of, you know, just little weird little things like that. Just anything that they could like pull from and turn things into different noise catalogs.
And then they grabbed a couple of us to do Pompey's Arena just to get a bunch of sounds going around. So, because that mm-hmm. was like an audience and stuff like that. So, but
oh yeah,
that
was like, boo.
Yeah. Stuff. Yeah, just so there was more than just Ted to get the I do remember that because like Retro has a pretty impressive Foley lab, like that audio lab is pretty
smokes,
badass.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah, so
it makes me want to go play it again just so I can listen intently for the sound effects. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Last question, which is from AC-QU9NG. Interesting name. Was there much reciprocal inspiration within the studio? Would you listen, for example, to a David Wise track or look at a level layout and purely on that be inspired to make a world or a level, in this case, look a certain way?
The music,
yeah, I'd say
came,
so.
Yeah, the music came a little bit later. So like a lot of the mm-hmm. tracks, I think, was the opposite. I think David would see one of our levels and then be like, "Oh, okay, I'm gonna record the music because the vibe of it fits, you know, Windmill Hills, you know, like, or Horn Top Hop, right? Like he understood that there's horns here, that's the gameplay element."
Yeah.
So from an audio, no, but from a visual, like abso-friggin-lutely. Like
oh,
I would
yeah.
see stuff that Ted was working on, that Sean or Matt or Reed or Amanda, and I'd be like, "Damn it, you know, like, I, yeah. you know, got to get back and step my game up," or, you know, like, "How did you do that? You know, like, show me, you know, like how you achieve that kind of effect, or can I borrow that model, you know," and stuff like that. So it was always inspiration.
Yeah, yeah.
So like a friendly like, yeah. competitiveness, so to speak.
I wouldn't even
call
it competitive.
It was very cooperative.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. It was a very tight little team. And you know, I mean, as far as like looking at something immediately being inspired, like we would get the you know, the gray boxes of the rooms and run through there, and immediately my mind would be like, "Oh, well, those platforms definitely need to be made out of a plane's wing with the access point in the middle being the plane's engine or something." Like I just look at it and be like, "Oh yeah, I know what I want to do with that." And like, you know, it's gonna be suspended by vines in a very Gilligan's Island sort of way, you know, just drawing off of different ideas for that and just basing it on what I had seen, kind of some of the concepts we had. Yeah,
I mean, I remember you taking one of the like ancient statues that I made for the water level, and then you worked on the level where like the lightning is striking, and I remember you like made an entirely new statue just by like taking pieces and like reconfiguring them in a new way, and you had like a mouth with like teeth coming out of it, and I remember mm-hmm. seeing that and be like, "Holy crap, I never imagined that, like from the base kind of like statue that I did for the kit, that something mm-hmm. new like that could be completely reconfigured in a completely fresh way." So it was always like inspiring to see that. And like conversely, like I was saying, like when I was working on Fruity Factory, again, I was like, "All right, this is a factory level." And like, I love like industrial kind of, like talking about interior design, like industrial aesthetic is like my jam. Like I love lofts. I love that factory vibe. So like for me, I was like,
mm-hmm.
"Oh man, I'm going to do like tall windows with like bricks and, you know, like wood, you know, beams and rafters going across the top and stuff like that. And so like, you see the art assets that other people kind of made, and then you're like, oh, I know how I can kind of adjust this awesome artwork to fit what I want to do. And, you know, so it was like always being thrown around like that, like constantly. So it was like really collaborative, like Ted said, like never competitive. Like, why would it be? Like, we're all making the same game. Like, I think maturity for me as an artist coming up in this industry is like, I stopped looking at my individual contribution and more the final thing that was developed. Like, I am very mm-hmm. proud of the art I made, of course, but I am more proud of the game that we made as a team. That thing stands the test of time. Mm. Very, very few people care about, you know, the rocket barrel or the steamship, right? Like, that's one part of it, but they care about Tropical Freeze, you know, mm-hmm. like they care about that game. And, you know, it's like, I met Ted working on that game, a lifelong friend. That's way more important than anything that I worked on that, you know? So, you know, it's maybe cliche, trite and sappy, but it's true, you know?
It's good though. You need to hear more of this, man. Cause like there's so much toxicity in the industry, particularly at the moment. So it's nice to hear this sort of stuff. Final question before I let you guys go. Do you have a favorite level in the game? You don't even have to have worked on it. You just your favorite level in the game.
That's a great question.
That is a great question. I haven't really thought about like a lot of the levels for that game in a long time too.
Well, I suppose, was there one level that you played through and you were just like, holy shit.
I do have a favorite level. It's a minecart level in the ocean world, and you go like underground and
with the 3D camera change.
Yeah.
And that's my favorite level. Yeah.
And Teague worked on that level, and he was a badass. And like,
gosh,
he did some. Yeah. There's another underwater level that he worked on as well. That there's like two, and I was always like, damn, that's a really fucking good level. So those two really come to mind for me that weren't levels that I worked on. One of my favorite levels that I worked on that no one ever really gets to see is, because it's a secret level, is I forget what it's called, but it's plungers. Like, so the whole level theme is about stepping on these time release dynamite. So like you're stepping on the plungers and everything's blowing up.
Yeah.
And that was a it was a very difficult level to work on because my art lead kind of like upended the tea table on me a little bit, wasn't thrilled with the direction I had taken the level and had me restart it. And I think it turned out better for that. But at the time I remember being pretty frustrated, but it's a favorite level of mine because I made it work under very kind of like tight deadline. And it's so.
Those secret levels are hard, man. Like, hard. Yeah.
That they are. For me, I remember, like, for me, it ended up being a lot less about, like, the actual gameplay that was going on, but just seeing, like, the artwork that people were putting together and just the stuff that, that other artists had worked on that I really, really enjoyed. Was there was a lot of really great stuff within, Bright Savannah. It was just really colorful and pretty. And, you know, just, also like Seabreeze Cove has some just gorgeous places in it. And
yeah,
so it's pretty darn neat. You know, it's just, I think probably the best aspect of anything is just seeing a game come together, and especially when you start really getting into the meat of production and you see that, all this is coalescing, it's coming together, and it's being very cohesive. It just, it fills your heart. It's great.
Mm.
Yeah. I mean, it's still 10 years on, probably one of my favorite projects that I've worked on. In a 20-year career, that's saying something. So that is until Project Saturn comes out. When Project Saturn comes out, it's going to be the best.
Do you guys want to do any plugs before we wrap up for your games? Obviously, Project Saturn. Ted, what are you working on at the moment?
So my personal game, we just started a brand new game over at Pixel Pushers, and we're just trying to get to the level of a demo right now. But we're doing a kind of throwback to the golden days of survival horror with stuff like Silent Hill 2 and the Resident Evils, you know, 1, 2, and 3. And we're doing one called Five Points Mall, and it's going to take place in an abandoned mall, and you're going to be using voice commands to help your characters solve puzzles, defeat bad guys, and unweave a pretty interesting story that's coming together right now. And we're doing it in a kind of retro style for that period, so like think like latest of 90s and early 2000s style art.
And I've seen some screenshots. It's effing cool looking, like. And that was early. That was early stuff. So I don't even know like the latest, but the stuff you showed me way back, I was like, "This is cool."
It's so, geez, yeah. It's a tease, man. It sounds very, very interesting.
Well, hopefully, we'll have something really cool to show pretty soon. We're getting the story. Have a good friend named Zach Guerno, who is doing us a story write up right now, and kind of it's almost like writing a script, really. Because we've got, you know, four characters plus you, and you all have interactions, and it's trying to find out kind of a mysterious unraveling the mystery of what's going on with this group and why you're here and why you can't get out. So
coming soon.
Yeah, we'll see. Yeah. Fingers crossed.
Cool. And Eric, Project Saturn.
Yeah, any so updates, we're getting closer and closer. I mean, stay tuned, fuzzybot.com. Hopefully, I don't know how much I could say, but yeah.
This year?
I think that's the plan.
Okay.
I think that's the plan. So it's pretty exciting. Oh. It's been a long road. I think it tops Tropical Freeze for my favorite project on Forte. I mean, I am art directing it, so
You got to believe in what you're working on.
Yeah, exactly. But no,
I can't
looks
wait
amazing.
To see it, man.
Yeah, the gameplay is super fun. Holy crap! Like the animation team is just crushing it. Hearing some new music the other day, like
Game Awards reveal.
I don't even know. That's beyond me. I'm so head down with just figuring out like you know all the day to day stuff managing. The team, but no, it's amazing. It's a fun project, and yeah, we'll probably have some updates on our website soonish, maybe. But you know, I think we've done some playtests on our Discord with our community and stuff like that. So we're indie, so we're not like as tight-lipped about things as like Nintendo is. But there is certain things that we want to surprise. It's more about surprising than being like super secretive and stuff like
fair
that.
Enough.
But like I said, we have like an open Discord that players can sign up for where we've shared concept art, we've shared screenshots,
that's cool.
Videos and stuff like that. So yeah, if any of your listeners are interested, like fuzzybot.com, there's a link to the Discord if they want to join and check it out. It should be heating up soon with new content and stuff like that. But yeah, in the meantime, just kind of heads down trying to bring this ship into port sometime.
Yeah.
So.
Well, good things take time, right?
Yeah, exactly. So.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Well, there's the show, everyone. Make sure you share, like, and subscribe. If you haven't played Tropical Freeze, shame on you. Go play it now. And, yeah, stay safe. Until next time. See you later. Bye.